You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening, hello, and welcome to Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud is one of the foundation's signature public programs. So thank you all for tuning in this evening. It's wonderful to see you. I'm not seeing you, but it's wonderful that you're all out there for this terrific program. As the Director of Public Programming for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, I'm proud to be involved in supporting Los Angeles Public Library, which helps to provide support to communities through access to information, educational assistance, literacy instruction, and also in making sure that everyone has the opportunity to enjoy books. Access is open to all those who are interested. The Aloud series is made possible through the support of the Library Foundation members. I just want to thank all of our members who are here attending this evening. And if you're not yet a member, please consider joining at lfla.org/support now. We have lots of dynamic programming coming this year, and you won't want to miss it. Along with current fiction programs, we're continuing to bring you programs that focus on issues that affect Los Angeles communities and communities beyond. Tonight, I'm very excited to introduce Paola Ramos with her inspiring new book, Finding Latinx, In Search of Voices Redefining Latino Identity. There are 60 million Latinos living in the United States and 4.9 living in Los Angeles. That's 9% of the nation's Hispanic population living right here. Ramos explores communities across our nation, defining themselves with the controversial name of Latinx. This travelogue documentary style book explores with passion and deep empathy what it means to be Latino and what it means to be American. As Ramos describes, quote, "The reality is that for decades, that ache for change was inside many of us. It was an ache that craved more unity, acceptance, and inclusion, an ache that simply wanted to be seen. This ache wasn't felt just inside the bubbles of activism, DC politics, and media. It was a sentiment that lay mostly in the fringes of those very elite spaces, inside homes and out of the public eye. It was in these places that I started recognizing that a lot more people than I thought were not only coming out as Latinx, but giving life to a word in a way no dictionary." Paola Ramos is the host and correspondent for Vice and Vice News, as well as a contributor to Telemundo News and MSNBC. Ramos was the deputy director of the Hispanic media for the Hillary Clinton 2016 presidential campaign and a political appointee during the Barack Obama administration. She also served in Barack Obama's 2012 re-election campaign. Paola will be in conversation with Fidel Martinez. Martinez is an audience engagement editor at the Los Angeles Times and is the writer and editor for LA Times' new Latinx Files, which comes out weekly. Please welcome Paola Ramos and Fidel Martinez. Thank you both for joining us. Thank you. Thank you. It's wonderful to have you both here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me and us.
Thank you so much. Yes.
Yes.
Hello.
How are you? So just for the people you know, watching us, we're just going to be having sort of a, hopefully a natural fluid conversation. I really enjoyed the book. I think it made me really think critically about, you know, Latinx identity. It's something that, because also the nature of my job, it's something that I think a lot about, but I found it to be very, very interesting because one of the things that really stuck out to me is it truly is something very undefinable. You know, and to take on this endeavor to find some contours of what that identity is, you know, I thought it was really interesting. So can you talk to me a little bit about how this book came about and what prompted you to embark on this project?
Yeah, of course. So to me, it begins in 2016, right? So in 2016, I was working in the Hillary Clinton campaign. And this was after, you know, several years in politics, having been in DC for a long time, in the Obama White House and believing that I knew everything about politics. And in that campaign, I had this very fancy title, Deputy Director of Hispanic Media. And come election day, we were all convinced that no matter what, right, what our polls predicted, what we believe, what the news predicted, was that Latinos would overwhelmingly show up to the polls, and that regardless of your political identity, you know, regardless if you're Republican or Democrat, in the face of someone like Donald Trump, we would show up in unprecedented numbers. And that was sort of what the morning was predicting. I remember looking at my phone and like the Miami Herald was saying that, like Miami-Dade, like Latinx folks were just voting in these like crazy numbers. And then of course, you know, it's 12 a.m. and that wasn't the story. Less than 50% of Latinos actually showed up. And I remember the day after that, I'd had this moment where I recognized that we didn't really understand what was truly going on, right? We had spent over 2 years in this campaign reaching out to folks, going to these battleground states, going to, you know, to Univision y Telemundo and like all of these media outlets trying to speak to us, but we were missing everyone, right? We were missing the message. We weren't really seeing who was out there. We weren't going everywhere we had to. And that was sort of the beginning of this book, right? A lot of this journey, a lot of these pages is me going back to these battleground states and going to the places and talking to folks and talking about issues that I never really did throughout years in politics.
Right. Because I mean, I think something that people sort of non-Latinx people are outside of our community, they assume that the number one topic that we care about is immigration. And obviously immigration is a very important topic, right? I mean, for me, like, I have family, like I belong to a mixed status family where we're several cousins and tios and tias, you know, they are
without documentation. Right?
Yeah. But it's also not the number one issue, you know, I mean, and yeah, so I think, you know, something that you mentioned was sort of this trip was sort of a journey to rethink what that identity is like. So, you know, it's 4 years later, that presidency, which began with him calling Mexican immigrants rapists and was bookmarked, and was ended by, you know, his very less than publicized trip to the Rio Grande Valley border to sign that little, you know, piece of wall. I mean, it's hard not to think of this as very much being not just like a presidency that you know, catered to and courted white supremacists, but it also was very much decidedly an anti-Latinx presidency, you know?
Completely. That was the beginning of, that was, as you said, no, that was very much the beginning and the end and the main message of his presidency, right? It was build the wall became the slogan that people rallied around. It was interesting though, for a second, I don't know if you noticed, like the last couple of months of Trump's campaign, he barely mentioned that, which I thought was fascinating, right? Like the last 2 months, there was no talk about immigration. There was no talk about the wall. And then suddenly he went to, then you're right. Then he went to the Valley, like obviously once he lost, but I think there was a moment there, and then we can talk about that, whether, and I think there was one moment where some pollsters believe that some of those white folks, particularly white women in suburban areas that had voted for him in 2016, there was some data that showed that perhaps in the light of family separation and zero tolerance and all of these different stories that popped up in the last 4 years, perhaps those people would then end up voting for Biden. And then it turns out that that wasn't the case, which was that's a whole other story. But yeah, that I thought was interesting.
I have your book with me, and one of the early things you do talk about the election, and I'd like to read this little passage because it's something that I've been thinking a lot about. That election will be remembered in American history as a moment that made a lot of us lean into our Latin identity. Language evolves, and it evolves as an expression of the political time we're in. And I believe the Latinx movement is the next step in that evolution. There's so much to unpack in that sentence because I think I agree. I think I would agree with you that this was that election was very much a defining moment for, you know, people finding their, you know, their Latinx roots or their heritage, right? Because it was basically being told, you're not an American And when you're sort of attacked like that, it sort of it sparks something in you. It's like the hell I am.
Totally. Yeah, and I think that's a lot of what we saw in this election. It's like suddenly, you know, maybe in 2012 and 2016, politics wasn't necessarily personal for some folks, right? Like we took a lot of things for granted, particularly like, you know, US born Latinos, right? But then I think in the last 4 years, it's like, there was no getting around politics, right? Like politics became personal, right? You knew someone that was deported. You knew someone that knew someone that had been affected in some shape or form by this administration, right? Even though you were a white Latino, someone in your neighborhood, just because of your last name, didn't want you to be there. And so I don't think there was a way around it. And yeah, I think it did make a lot of people sort of lean into who we were with a little bit more pride than we had in the past, and including myself. No, I think for years, I've had the privilege of having this light skin and sort of taking for granted a lot of these spaces that I've moved in. And then suddenly it was like, all right, what does it mean to carry this last name, to have this background, to be in a community and not truly understand who's around me, you know? And so yeah, I think it's in the midst of a lot of darkness, I think a lot of great things came out of it.
Yeah, no, 100%. So now the second part, that you believe the Latinx movement is the next step in this evolution. Can you expand on that a little bit? Like, how would you define the Latinx movement?
Look, I think the first thing that we have to say, or that at least I want to say, is there's it's not a mystery that this word is extremely controversial, right? Like, I think most people, and I would love to hear what you think, most people right now don't love the word, right? And I think part of the problem is because there is a massive like push from certain folks that either have framed the word as this like, you know, it's, I've heard, again, I'm from Miami. And so when I'm in Miami and people say Latinx, they're like, oh no, that's a communist word. No, that word, I've heard that many times. And there's many ways to interpret the word. The way that I use it right now, I don't think it's perfect. I don't think it's the word. I think that right now, as it stands, it's the only word that attempts to be as inclusive as possible, right? It's the first time that in one word, we try and bring Afro-Latinas under this umbrella, indigenous folks under this umbrella, trans folks, queer folks, you know, English-speaking Latinos, Midwestern Latinos. It's at least an attempt to see us all under the same light. And I don't think we have ever seen our community in that way. I think when we talk about immigration, we don't think about undocumented Black folks, right? And when we talk about criminal justice, we don't think about Latinos. We don't think about Afro-Latinos. And when we talk about the Midwest and we talk about the blue wave, we don't talk about the role that Latinx folks have played in creating that change. And so that's what I mean about a movement, right? I don't think there's necessarily like a Latinx banner with a flag and we're all moving in it. But I do think if we see us through that light, you start to find unity and start to see the connecting points among us. And I think it's necessary because I think we're at a point where we're extremely fragmented. No, there's many forces that are pushing us in different directions. And I think at least we can have these conversations about, okay, what's connecting us? What's not? What do we have in common? And what are the policy issues that we can start sort of fighting together? So, yeah.
Yeah. So a quick follow-up, what would that flag look like? No, I'm kidding. So you brought up the term Latinx, right?
What is it like for you? You're in LA, and what is it like there?
It's funny because so a lot of the pushback that I get on the term Latinx, like the reason why I use it are the very same reasons that you've outlined, right? I agree that it is an imperfect term. You know, I mean, there's even going down to the way in which it's pronounced. Some people have say it Latinx, you know, others say it Latinx. You know, I prefer Latinx just because it's easier to say for me, you know? Even though it's imperfect, I do think it's the most inclusive word that there is, because it is a recognition that, you know, you know, trans folk exist within our community, that, you know, non-Spanish speaking, you know, folks exist within our community. And in a way, it's sort of an acknowledgement, like for me, like I'm from Texas, right? So I would define myself in terms of like Tejano, right? Because it's a very specific of a region, you know, and it's easy for me because I'm a straight man, you know, I don't have to think about my gender because it's not something that I've never really, you know, I've never really had to like think critically. Well, I mean, let me rephrase that. It's never been something that it's a privilege, you know? And I think that's something that, you know, the term Latinx is, it's sort of a recognition that many of us have privilege, even if we might not recognize it, you know? Yeah. But yeah, I think you said that people call it a communist word. My experience has been like, oh, it's a white academic,
also, yeah,
liberal word. And the thing about it is there's this misconception that we are forcing it on people. Like, okay, don't use it. Cool. You hate it. Great. Call yourself whatever you like, you know? Yeah. And, but even then, I mean, I feel like people just have such a visceral reaction to it, which I think, why do you think people have that visceral reaction?
I think about that all the time, right? I think it's two things. I do think there's a lot of legitimacy behind saying like it's a white sort of whitewashed version of us. Sure. Let's talk about that. But I'm always fascinated by the folks that are just so livid when you say the word. And to me, I think there's something, and I think it's part of the discussion. I think when you tell some Latinx folks, when you tell some Latinos that in their same community, there are people that are Black and that are people that are trans, I think some people cannot stand that, right? I think some people have never seen themselves in the same space as people that don't look like themselves, right? And at least I've lived that and I've learned that a lot in Miami, right? In Florida. You know, I've been around in the Cuban American community for a long time. I love them. They're part of my family. But there is a lot of internal racism, right? We grow up with a lot of internal biases. And when you put, you know, another Cuban, a Black Cuban refugee in Miami and they're deported, people don't care. Right. And so that's what I want to like, understand, right. And deconstruct, because the rejection that comes from that word, when you try and make it more inclusive, some people do not want that. And that, you know, that's a whole other debate. That's a whole other string of Latinx, which is also understanding that, like, you know, a lot of Democrats do take us for granted. There is obviously this like concept, you know, this idea that, you know, Latinx folks are Democrats. We're all liberals. We're going to show up to the polls. We just became the largest minority voting bloc. And that's not true, right? Like the 30% of us vote Republican and that number keeps growing. And so that's also part of understanding Latinx, right? That we also are, there are Republican folks. There are Trump folks. There are white supremacists among us. And so I think that's as important to understand.
Yeah. You know, speaking since we veered towards this topic. I obviously we are not a monolith, you know, it feels so like every time I say it, it's like a little part of me dies just because we've been saying it so much, you know, but it's true. Like the fact is we are not monolithic, you know, and, you know, for me, you know, you mentioned Miami, I never had to think, you know, critically about my Latinidad or my identity until I moved to Miami. I moved there for 3 years. And for me, it was such a foreign, it was such a, you know, being Mexican American and living in a city that was, you know, Latina, like a Latinx city, but it wasn't my specific identity. Yeah. It opened up my eyes, you know, in so many ways. And it made me realize like, oh, my experience is just my experience, you know, and it's not the end all catch all for every other person, you know, that has a Spanish surname, you know.
Completely.
But, you know, you also mentioned, you know, the fact that a portion of our community, you know, tends to lean Republican and, you know, some of them believe in white supremacy, which, you know, brings me to, I want to ask you about one of the subjects of your book, someone who has been in the news a lot lately, and that is Enrique Tarrio, you know, who is, I believe he is the president of the Proud Boys. Correct me.
Yeah, Enrique was, is, it's unclear what the status is right now, but for folks that are watching this, Enrique Tarrio, for the past 2 years, has been the chairman of the Proud Boys. He was named at least 2 years ago, right? And he was one of the lead, he's been the chairman of that entity. He is sort of the lead organizer in Florida for Latinos for Trump. Yeah. And right, the story is that he's Afro-Cuban, no? He's a Black Cuban that was appointed as the chairman of the entity.
Right, which I really enjoy that chapter because it forced me to have some empathy for someone who I would just like, you know, and it's something that you say in your chapter, like if under other circumstances, I would never even like, I would walk away from this person. Right. And it just, yeah. I think it does it. That chapter in particular does a great job at highlighting just how diverse our community is. So what was that whole process like? How did you reach out to him? Why did he agree to speak with you?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know why he agreed to speak. I mean, I do know, right? I think so much, regardless of Enrique, I think so much of the Proud Boys, and that's, I'm sure you may struggle with this, is seeking attention, right? And it's like, how much do we, you know, as journalists want to give them a platform, which is something that I struggle with, right? But I thought with someone like Enrique Tarrio, it was worth having those conversations with. He's someone that when I read about him, I was like, I can't believe this. No, there is a Black Cuban in Miami, like a mile away from where I live, that is not just a huge Trump supporter, right? But is the lead figure of the Proud Boys. And so I couldn't believe it. And so the first encounter I had with him was awful. Like I remember walking into his house, my body language was, I was just like this the whole time. Everything he said, I wasn't really listening. And so, you know, I was sort of believing my own stereotypes, right? How can it be that this person that is also Cuban as I am loves Trump and loves this idea of like Western chauvinism? No, I couldn't believe that. And then I remember leaving that interview and it didn't really go that well. And I called him again. I was like, you know what? Like, let's do this again by phone. And we talked for like 2 hours. And in that conversation, you know, I started to understand that Enrique, again, the Black Cuban, Latino and Black, is someone that in a place like Florida didn't really belong anywhere, right? In the system, like the system sort of failed him, right? Neither Republicans nor Democrats sort of took him as theirs, right? He wasn't Latino enough to be a Democrat. He wasn't Black enough to be a Democrat. He wasn't conservative enough in sort of the traditional sense to be a Republican. And sort of, he was sort of left in the system. And then Trump comes in and I remember asking him, what is it about him that you sort of fell in love with, right? Like, I don't get it. What is it about him? And he was like, you know, and again, I don't agree with any of him. We could not, I mean, we're like opposite sides of the spectrum, but he was like, he is someone that even though I know he's nothing like me, he told me, he's like, él habla calle, no? Él habla como calle. He talks like me, no? He gets me, we're in the same level. And I think beyond that, right? Beyond having someone that was in his level, I think there's this like undercurrent among us where there are some Latinos that because we have been normalized, because so many of us have been normalized to accept that power is where white people are, no? Power is status. Power is when you don't speak Spanish. It's when you sort of put your head down and assimilate. In that process, you start to reject the other. You start to reject the new immigrants. You start to reject the other Latinos. You start to reject, Latinidad. And most people that I talked to in Miami, including Enrique, who's like as Latino as you can be, who's like Cuban accent is like thicker than my grandparents. He's like, I'm not Latino. Like I'm a white man, right? Like I am white and I am American. And they don't want to own anything other than that. No. And so in Trump, they saw belonging. And I don't understand that. Right. I think that is racist. I think everything he symbolizes and he has done is awful, but I do understand, right? At least I try and understand the pain that may drive someone to want to reject their identity so much, right? And I think that's part of Enrique's story, you know? And you find it a lot in different places around the country, right? That there is this growing number of folks that feel at home because white people are making them feel that. And I don't believe it. I don't accept it, but I want to understand it, right? Because I think it starts with us. Right? It's something among Democrats. It's something among in this country, something in the system that has made them feel that way.
Yeah. And to be clear also, it's not just people like Enrique who are rejecting the notion of Latinidad, right? One of the most fascinating reads of the last year was by this woman named Dash Harris Machado, who wrote for Refinery 29, in which she talks about how Latinidad, you know, she's Afro-Latina, and for her, Latinidad has always been, you know, a reminder that she's seen as less than, right? So, I think that was a takeaway from that chapter is, like you, obviously, there's very little of that he believes, or if any, that I would agree with, but I also understand what that feeling of like wanting to belong to something is like, right?
And that's the sort of like, you know, as that's one of the things that I'm so fascinated about this election, right? At the numbers, when you look at them, like they're amazing, right? Like more Latinos showed up in unprecedented numbers. Like I think almost more than 60% of Latinx folks showed up to vote. But when you look at a lot of the counties, the ones with like heavy immigrant folks, there was a slight shift to the right in almost all of those counties across the country. And so I think I don't have an answer for that. They're not all Enrique Tarrios, but I think that's worth digging into, no?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I'm from the Rio Grande Valley, you know, and to me, it's like, it was really weird. Just like all of a sudden, y'all want to talk about the Rio Grande Valley when you've like historically ignored this region. Yeah. You know, you have people parachuting in and like pretending like they're experts. And like, I grew up in the Rio Grande Valley. Honestly, here's my theory. And this is just based on my own experiences growing up here and sort of witnessing, you know, some of the conversations. Because some of these people I grew up with, you know, and you just assume that, oh yeah, no, you all think the same thing that I do, right? But obviously that's not true, right? You know, for example, for me, something that I think immigration is clearly, there's obviously immigration, right? But the fact is that the Rio Grande Valley is, if not the poorest, the second poorest region in the entire country. And when there was a huge influx of, you know, Central American migrants, there was that resentment where it was like, well, you're not even my kind of Latino, so, or Latinx. So why are you here? This is not your land, you know? And that paired up with the fact that, I mean, at the end of the day, I think, you know, not enough can be said about the fact that when people received that first stimulus check, it had Donald Trump's name on it. And people were like, well, this guy literally gave me money, you know? So I think
hear that a lot while I was there, a lot. I mean, I was there like a month before the election covering COVID. And I mean, like the Rio Grande Valley had one of the worst rates per capita of COVID-19. And like the whole story was about just how, you know, how affected and how people were dying left and right. And so 2 weeks later, you see this and I was like, wait, what just happened? But you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, the wall is right behind you, but people are just trying to survive. You know, people just want a paycheck. And it's how do you get by? And I thought a lot of it also had to do with messaging, you know? Who was messaging there? Who was present? And I think that's another big thing of our community. You know, if you are present, if you're present, not just 2 weeks before, but throughout for the last year, you know, trust is very important. And I do have to say, like the Republicans were present. They were present. They messaged a lot.
Yeah. I want to talk about COVID. And this does actually pertain to your book, I promise. Obviously COVID has, you know, the Latinx and the Black community have both been bearing the brunt of this pandemic every step of the way, whether it's on the economic side, on the, you know, the disproportionate number of Latinx and Black folk who have been, you know, infected with a virus, and even the vaccine distribution, which, you know, the New York Times recently did an article in which, you know, even in predominantly minority communities, it was white individuals and wealthy individuals who were getting the vaccine. And my colleague, Julia Wick for the LA Times, wrote a story about, you know, people from, you know, younger, affluent white people from the West Side going to communities where Black and brown people live to get the vaccine, right? So there's this sort of notion of, you know, our community perpetually being on the losing end of things, right? And that's something in reading your book, that's something that comes up a lot, you know, the notion of resiliency as a Latinx trait, which I think, you know, when I first thought about it, I was like, hell yeah, we're resilient people. We survive, you know, civil wars, we survive dictatorships, we survive all of these things. But then the more I kept thinking about it is like, but why did we have to? Why do we always have to endure and survive, you know? And it's, I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on that.
No, I mean, you're right. I mean, that's the biggest hypocrisy we're living right now, no? Our community, there's millions of our folks that are essential workers, no? That are in the front lines and that are literally saving lives. And yet they're at the back end of everything. And so that, again, I think at least Congress is debating that right now. So that's a step in the right direction. But I think, you know, that is the biggest question that I think we're dealing with right now. What does it truly mean to be essential, right? If then at the end of the day, we're dying at higher rates and we're not getting the help we need. But I mean, that's one of the things that I noticed was this shift, right, in the different generations, right? Perhaps the older generation of folks would sort of take for granted this idea that, you know, it's a privilege to be in this country, right? It is, we're here. And put your head down, you have a job, and you're given a paycheck, put your head down and don't make noise. And so I think what I did notice in every single trip, every single state, every single conversation that I had, particularly with the younger generation of folks, it was this idea that like they saw their parents sort of suffer and normalize this pain and normalize exactly what you just said, which is these stats. But the younger generation of folks, at least every single person that I talked to, you know, aren't that's it. Like that's enough, right? And I do think there's a shift that's happening where like, because many younger Latinas are US born, right? Because many of us have the privilege of this, you know, of a passport, because some dreamers, you know, are the bravest among us. They're speaking out, right? And they're sort of, again, speaking out and leading into this identity in ways that like our parents and many older generation of Latinos weren't able to. No, they don't have the privilege of doing that. They don't have the papers. They don't sort of have like the culture around them to do that. And I think that gives me hope, no? Because that's something that I noticed across the country in every single state where like there is this rejection of the status quo and this rejection of what our, you know, what the older generation went through. And even now, I mean, I'm seeing it. There's a movement, right? There is a massive movement of activists in every single state that is pushing Congress to not just pass this COVID relief bill, but to legalize, right, and grant citizenship to essential workers, right? There's no fear there. And that's worth sort of highlighting.
Yeah. Wow. Do you think that immigration reform as it currently is will pass? Yes or no? I'm a cynic. I actually wrote about this, how, you know, the topic of immigration reform has just, I mean, immigration reform has been on the national conversation for so long that at one point Marco Rubio was the face of immigration reform, you know. Remember that? But no, I think you're right. And I think, you know, when reading your book, some of the things that I came across was like, well, you are saying what being Latinx isn't, you know. I mean, in the chapters in which you profile the indigenous communities, you know, that challenges the notion that Spanish is a marker of Latinx identity, which is clearly very much, I mean, that's pretty, you know, colonialist thinking. If you know, like I didn't realize that until like, but it's true, no, right? I mean, it's that's
same. I mean,
that's why so the much, Hispanic.
Exactly. So much of the book was undoing my own biases and undoing my own like colonialism, 100%, right? And part of it was understanding, like for me, one of my favorite chapters was being in Arizona, being at the border, right? Like every time I go to the border, I go and I talk to like Spanish-speaking immigrants. I'm in Matamoros, I'm in other places, and that's the story. But in Arizona, the story was like, you know, the majority of migrants that are crossing through the Arizona border are indigenous migrants. Many of them are coming from Guatemala. And when they show up, they're not saying hola, they're not talking in English or in Spanish, they're speaking in Mam or in Cancobal or a lot of their indigenous Maya languages. And that's just one part of the story, you know? And then what does it mean to sort of navigate the immigration system in that language? And then what does it mean to migrate, right, to different parts of the United States and to grow up in that culture? And so the best part was like being in Georgia, you know, being in the South, and being in the like reddest counties with like Trump flags everywhere. And then suddenly seeing this like incredibly rich and big Maya community that has been there, not just now, but for like for years, for decades. Many of them came during the Atlanta Olympics and many stayed. And yeah, and you're right. And that's it. And again, I am not here to say that indigenous folks and Maya folks identify as Latinx. That would be an error to say that. The point is that they are there. No, the point is that when we're talking about a state like Georgia, when we're talking about these like diverse coalitions that created change, that's them too. No, they're there too. They're in rural Georgia too. And that was just, that was incredible. And that was a big like eye-opening experience for me, like understanding just like how big and, you know, the indigenous community is there.
Yeah. So, you know, if it's not language, if it's not immigration, you know, what is it, do you think, that defines Latinx?
I mean, I think, look, I'm right now I'm in Panama, and that's why I'm like in some weird hotel right now. And yeah, like I've been in Colombia and I've been in Panama, and no one here even says like, oh yeah, I'm Latino, I'm Latina, this and that, right? So I think to start with, it is a very like Latinx is a very, it is the story of the Latino in the US. I think that first of all. Second of all, I think it tries to embrace our story and our experience within those borders. But I think more to me, the way that I see it is, regardless of your generation, no, regardless of where you come from, every single one of us has, regardless of the color of your skin, we all have an immigrant story, right? There is someone in your lineage, there is someone in your family that migrated to the United States for one idea, and just for this big idea of bringing more opportunity to us, no, bringing sort of freedom and liberty to us. And so I think within that, if you understand that and you believe that, and that is part of your story, which is the same story if you're a conservative or you're a liberal, if you believe that, then leaning into your identity, whether you're queer or you're Black or you're Latino or you're white, you speak Spanish or English, then you have to embrace that. No, we have to embrace our differences. And that is a very, to me, like very unique Latinx experience, which is like the story of the immigrant, no? Which is you lean in to as much freedom and liberty as you have, as you can. And right now, to me, what Latinx does is exactly that. No, it is embracing every single one of us, regardless of how you speak, what you look like, who you love, how many languages you talk, that's it. And we've never been at a point where we can all look at each other in one room and be like, oh yeah, like it's all of us. So that's,
yeah, you know, no, that's, I think that's very well put, and I think it's very beautiful. And you know, it's, for me, you know, Latinx identity is more of a, I still think it's not yet defined, and it will never be defined, right? Because everybody gets to define themselves however they want. Yeah. But especially now, right? We've been told what, you know, Latinx community has been for so long, right? You know, there's this narrative of like immigrants, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I do think you are right that we are at a very sort of a pivotal moment in which, because there is this challenging of the status quo, there's this rejection of what we've been told we're supposed to be like. And now we're like, okay, now we know that's not who we are, but who right. are we really? And we're sort of in this path of discovery, right? It's sort of like, it's so freeing and scary and terrifying because I don't know what, you know, what that journey is going to be like, you know?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And again, I think that's the beauty of this, that we're taking the time and the space to have these conversations. Like, and sometimes they're the most basic questions, right? And like, I remember being, even this time in politics, it's like, we've literally never, pollsters have never said after 20 years of trying to understand who Latinos were. And so they, you know, they look at folks like my parents are like, sure, they're, you know, immigrants came here from Mexico and Cuba, but no one has posed the most simple question, which is, okay, like, who is the younger generation of Latinos? Like, how different are they? And it's basic stuff. And so this is it, no? It's understanding, like, what does it mean to be born in this country or not, to be a dreamer and live with the freedoms that our parents wanted us to have? What does that look like? No, and that's right. That's what we're talking about.
Well, and also to add to that, I feel like, you know, Latinx folks or Latino, I really don't like the term Hispanic.
No, me neither.
Yeah, and it was, I knew for the fact, I knew something that your book taught me is I knew that the term was started by Hispanic woman in the Nixon administration. What I did not know was that she was part of Trump's Hispanic Council, which kind of, you know, blew my mind. You know, and I feel like it says so much about that. It really did. I mean, it made sense, but I'd never really thought about it, you know. It was like, oh, that makes, like, it was like, oh, that makes so much sense, right?
Yeah.
But I had another question for you, and it just sort of, I've lost my train of thought, but no, I remember now. So I think it's important. I think I would agree with you that defining Latinx as being US-based is very critical and very important.
Yeah,
and which is not to say that we're exclusionary of you know, folks from Latin America, but it's, and that's one of the criticisms that I always hear is like, people in Latin America don't say that they're, you know, Latinx. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, okay, that is completely true. And that's why we're defining this to the States, right? But another thing that people don't, you know, everybody assumes that, so I had the experience of, you know, I grew up in the border, right? And so I never really, like, I was going back and forth. So I always felt like I was from here and from there.
Yeah.
But the moment that I spent, you know, some time in Oaxaca, the first thing that I lost when I crossed, you know, went that far into Mexico was a Mexican from my Mexican American identity. Because as much as I would have seen I see myself as Mexican, people in Oaxaca were like, no, you're not, dude.
No, you're not.
You're not. Yeah. You know, and that was a very revelatory moment for me. So I do think it's important, you know, to contextualize this in within the boundaries of the United States.
Completely. No, I agree. And I think part of what's so unique about this is that, you know, we're wearing many different hats. You know, we are the kids of immigrants. I'm like half Mexican, half Cuban. I grew up somewhere, I speak a weird, like my Spanish is, like my accent is super weird. Like we say, no, ni de aquí, ni de allá. And so that hybrid, we can dismiss it, but that is the essence of what it means to be us in a way, no? We're a little bit of this, a little bit of that, no? And I think it is, whereas our parents didn't really get to like define what it meant to be American, because again, they didn't get that privilege to do that because of their papers, because of the economic status, because of many things. We get to define what's American now. No, we sort of have that privilege of saying like, no, it's a little bit of this and that, but you're right. I think it's super important to note that it is, at least as it currently stands and how I see it, like it is a very US centric term. I do think though, that there are a lot of, you know, I think there may be some patterns where we can start looking across the border and be like, understand like what's happening in Argentina with like the feminist movement there, no? What's happening in Chile with the queer movement there, and what's happening even here where I am. I was just in the Colombia-Panama border and there's a massive migration movement in that border. Like, let's not lose track of that as well. And so I think at least, I hope the future of the term is that it forces us not just to look inward, but to look outward and understand like, how are we connected in ways that perhaps, you know, we haven't really been thinking about. Where does erasure start from? the erasure doesn't, for us, like it doesn't start here. For me, it started the fact that like my family in Mexico never ever talked about like Afro-Mexicans and Afro, you know, and Black folks, because it was never part of the history that they were taught. No, it was erased from the start. And that's a mistake. That's not true. So the erasure in the history and the movement starts across the border. And so my hope is that it forces us to sort of push that barrier too.
Yeah. No. Well, I think that's a great point to sort of, transition into our Q&A portion of this event. I was like, we talked earlier today and I was a little bit worried that we would not have much to say. And honestly, I could talk about this forever. I mean, plus we're Latinos. We love to talk, you know, like that's how we do. Not to like, you know, border on stereotypes, but you know, we love to tell stories, you know? So, yeah. And I'll read the first question. In our path of discovery, where do we go with Latinx to make sure it is inclusive, intergenerational, and anti-racist?
And also, Fidel, you're in this as much as I am, so feel free to answer.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely.
That's a great question. I'm in the midst of figuring out that exercise. And you know, this phone has been like my biggest weapon, where like I use Instagram and Twitter to like ask folks what I'm not seeing, what I'm doing wrong. And you know, I think the best example right now that I can give is I do a lot of like segments with Telemundo too, right? Like beyond my stuff with Vice and so forth and NBC, like a lot of my work is with Telemundo. And even in, you know, part of my gig there is getting us, including myself, to understand that our audience is also Black, right? And that our audience is also like, you know, young, and that we speak Spanglish. And so what I try and do as much as I can is try and include Afro-Latino voices in the panels, right? Try and get source out videos from, you know, my Instagram followers that have things to say from the Midwest, from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and from the border, and make them part of the conversation. And so I don't have the best answer for that other than constantly asking questions, right? And understanding and recognizing that I have 1% of the answer. You know, the answer is elsewhere. And it's taking far too long for us to like to ask these tough questions. So with the small platform that I have, it's always about trying to include as many voices as I can to shape the conversation. And I don't know if you did how you're dealing with
no,
it.
No, I wholeheartedly agree with you there. I mean, one of the tenets, you know, when we launched a newsletter, the Latinx Files, was like, I am going into this under the assumption that I don't know everything and I might get things wrong. And to be open-minded when someone points, like challenges something that I might say, right? And I do think that the asking questions is the best way to do it, not just of others, but of yourself as well. You know, I mean, I think, especially when you have privilege, like you and I do, I think it's very easy to deflect and not think about that privilege because, you know, I mean, historically speaking, you know, we like as members of the Latinx community, we have faced injustices. You know, but that doesn't mean that that doesn't preclude us from having privilege, right? So I think recognizing that, you know, when there is privilege, to question that and to think about that. And there's a follow-up question, and I am really curious to hear your thoughts on this. And that question is, do you think that Latinx will end up being subsumed into whiteness as it has happened to Italian Americans, Irish Americans, etc.?
I think the intention of the word is to exactly prevent that, right? I think to me, at least growing up, no, when I heard the term Latino or Latina, there's an image that popped up, and I don't know how it was for you, Fidel. Like I remember when I heard the term Latina, I thought of like my experience growing up, which was like watching Univision and seeing like white Latinas on TV that looked a very certain type, with very stereotypical futures. And I think when you say that word right now, as it stands, two politicians, like two different institutions, there is a stereotype and an image that comes to mind, right? I think the word is loaded with a history and a story and an image that is not completely accurate. And I think, to me, the only intention behind the award right now is to break that stereotype, right? Is to at least get people to understand that it also includes Black Latinas, that it also includes trans Latinas, and that it also includes Latinx folks from the Midwest and from the border and the Central Valley. And so my hope is that it exactly forces the opposite effect, right? Which is break the white stereotype that comes with Latino and Latina identity, which to me, as it stands, is like, I think most people, and it's true, like most people I talk to, I say, and I'll ask you, when I say Latina, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
I mean, probably the same, you know, images that you had, because I grew up watching Univision and Telemundo and, you know, being in the border at Televisa, you know, and what they show is like whiteness, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, and yeah, it's absolutely. But I do feel that I don't think it's going to be subsumed. I'm sure portion members of our community will want that, you know, and they'll seek it out. And that's absolutely fine. You know, I think everyone is entitled to define themselves or identify themselves however they like, you know. But I just, you know, keep thinking a lot about, you know, all these studies in terms of like the predictions based on demographics. You know, I think, mm-hmm. you know, by 2050, I believe either 2050 or 2060, there is going to be about 110 million Latinx people in this country, which will account for about 30% of the entire country's population. Yeah. When there's that many, you know, of us, it's like, I don't see like these, you know, us being subsumed into whiteness, you know? Yeah. And yeah. I'm, you know, I'm hoping that's the case, because I do think that, you know, we do have, I think something that really makes me proud of being Latinx is having this, you know, having roots somewhere that, you know, is mm-hmm. easily accessible, or like, I know about my roots, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this is another great question. And the question is, in my experience, it's been cis heterosexual males who have shown the most resistance to using the word Latinx. Is that consistent with what you've seen? If so, do you think we'll be able to truly embrace the word in our community, considering that historically men have acted as gatekeepers for language?
Is that consistent? Yes, actually.
Wholeheartedly agree.
What, really?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I wholeheartedly agree that it's consistent, like
with what you've heard
with men who are the most.
What, yes, definitely. I think that's interesting. Yeah. The most rejection and like livid rejection I get is from white Latino men, cis straight men. But no, I think it's changing, right? I think when I look at Congress right now, when I look at like political power, again, you can love or hate Ocasio, like AOC, but she's using the word. No, she's changing language. She's changing politics. Like suddenly I'm from New York, and suddenly from our state, we have a Black, Latino, queer man in Congress. Again, he's changing power. And so, no, I think language is changing, right? All of a sudden you have Elizabeth Warren in a debate stage saying the term Latinx. That's changing language too. I don't think it's going to happen overnight, right? I think it's a debate that we're having. But no, I think suddenly like politics is shifting, right? Suddenly like activists are pushing President Biden and are holding him accountable, right? And these are the same folks that understand the importance of being inclusive. Perhaps Latinx is not the best word for them, and it's not the first choice in the vocabulary, but they do understand the importance of being inclusive, and that's what matters, no? And so no, I feel hopeful that there is like things are changing, and power is shifting.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that, you know, I think it's important to sort of contextualize, you know, some like the watershed moment of when the term Latinx really gained popularity, which was shortly after the 2006. Teen mm-hmm. Pulse shooting, you know, in Orlando. And I think that was very much an attack on Latinx folk, because it was Latin night at Pulse, mm-hmm. you know. So I feel like I think that was like, for me as someone who's a straight man, like that affected me, you know, because it was my community. Even though I identify as a straight man, it was still people from my community that were hurting, right? So I do think that the word, and language is ever evolving. Mm-hmm. I mean, the word Hispanic is an invention from the 1960s. We're not talking, right. we're talking about a couple of decades from now. But I do think that there is hope in me that the term or a term like it that aims to be inclusive will survive. Because, quite frankly, the reality of our community is that we are disproportionately young. Out of all the ethnic groups, we are the youngest, We're the youngest. Yeah. The average age of a Latinx person is 30 years old, And when you look at who constitutes our community, 6 in 10 people are millennials or younger. And for me, I love the kids. The kids are great. They are, like you said, they're like forward pushing and challenging us to, get rid of the toxic aspects of our culture. I also think that I think it will survive. And I believe this might be the last question, so I'll go ahead and ask it. Mm-hmm. So the pandemic has disproportionately affected the Latinx community in parts because many in the community are essential workers on the front lines who lived in mixed status, multi-generational households and are genuinely afraid to access necessary care and treatment for COVID and other illnesses because of their immigration status. Through your book, we're introduced to some wonderful people in the Latinx community. If you've had ongoing and recent contact with people featured in your book, can you please share with us how they are doing and how the pandemic has impacted them?
Yeah, I try and keep in touch with as many people as possible. And unfortunately, I think the majority of the subjects and the majority of the people in the book have been affected by COVID. Like everyone knows someone that was affected by it, that was taken by it. To me, what stands out the most is the trans community, right? And so one of the follow-up stories that I did during COVID was of the trans migrant community in New York, and many of them that had relationships with one of the people that I interviewed in Arizona, Carolina Lopez, and she's a trans Latina there, and folks of her community. One of the most incredible things that I understand with the trans Latinx community is what resilience means, what it truly means to survive. And throughout the pandemic, I spent a lot of time with them. And many were forced, right? Because they weren't getting any COVID relief form, because even though they were frontline workers and weren't making enough money, many of them were forced to do sex work and to survive, right? To make it. And that to me was like the ultimate, again, like realization of just like the hypocrisy of this country, right? Like here are frontline workers and here are people that need our help the most. And yet they have to like expose themselves to this virus unwillingly and resort to sex work. And, I think about that constantly, and they will be probably the last ones to get the vaccine. And so that's, that sticks with me. I think about it a lot. And until the day that they all get vaccinated, this thing won't be over.
Yeah. Could have said it better myself. Yeah. Well, Paola, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation. This is truly a delight. And
thank you, Felix.
Read her book.
Thank you both so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Paola. Thank you, Fidel. This was an incredible conversation. I feel like this was an important one, and I'm really glad that you guys were here. I'm grateful. So thank you both so much. And yes, buy Paola's book. It's fantastic. And also please join us on February 9th at 3 p.m. for Elijah Cummins' memoir. It will be discussed with Dr. Maya Arakamore Cummins and James Dale. It should be a fascinating and interesting conversation about the state of things, about social justice and the rest. Thank you guys for both being here. And thank you all those who tuned in. And thank you members for making this possible. Take care.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.